You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Well, welcome back to another episode of the Buffalo Happy Hour. We are here. Mike is not here today. It's just me. We are here in the Addy's tasting room with a new friend. We'll get to introductions in a second. Just want to thank Addy's again for hosting us, letting us use the tasting room for another interview. We have a really exciting one today. We have a representative from MGP who is going to be talking about their process, and then we're going to be tasting some great juice that he brought. So you want to do a little bit of introduction, and we'll go from there?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I'm Ian Sturzman. I'm the master distiller of MGP's Ross and Squibb Distillery.
So people hear us talk about it all the time, like MGP as a whole. Can you kind of explain a little bit what MGP is?
Yeah, MGP is a lot right now. So we do a lot of contract distilling. So we make the whiskeys, especially the rye whiskeys, GNS, gin, that go into a lot of different brands. We also have some food ingredient business, but that's not really what we're here to talk about. And MGP started in Atchison, Kansas, and they started with a large distillery making GNS and gin, contract distillation mostly. And then in 2011, they purchased our distillery, and that's when they really got into making the whiskeys, the bourbons, rye whiskeys.
So Ross and Squibb, what's the origin of that? Because that goes before MGP acquired you, obviously. So did you make primarily rye before then?
So our history, so we were MGP of Indiana after 2011 when MGP purchased us. And then we acquired Luxco a couple years ago. And with that, there came a few more distilleries, the Limestone Branch Distillery, where Yellowstone Bourbon's made, the Lux Row Distillery, where Ezra and Rebel are made, and then Distillador Gonzalez, where we make some of our tequilas like El Mayor. And with that, we also wanted to focus more on our own brands coming from the Lawrenceburg Distillery. So we wanted to give the Lawrenceburg Distillery a name that meant a little more than MGP of Indiana, and that really paid tribute to the history we have there at the distillery. Because the distillery's been around since 1847.
Okay.
So we're one of the oldest, we have as much history as pretty much any distillery out there in the U.S. at least. So
when MGP approached the distillery, the standing distillery that's been around for a while, what was that discussion like? Do you know?
That was before my time. Yeah. So I don't really know, but it was, it was really good timing for them because in 2011, we were kind of getting out of a bourbon glut.
Sure.
And whiskey was really, American bourbon was really just starting to take off. Rye whiskey was really just starting to take off. So I don't know how those conversations went. I wasn't part of them, but it was good timing for them.
It had to be fascinating, though, because, so MGP itself, you talked about contract distillation. How much of it is kind of out there in the world? You don't have to give, actual distillery names or brand names out there, but, how much does MGP actually contract out?
It's a lot. We don't talk specific volumes. Sure. Just we're publicly traded, and we've never made that information public.
Oh, okay.
So we can't talk specific volumes, but you know, you go to a store like where we're at right now, and you look around the shelves and turn bottles around, start looking. Distilled in Indiana is going to be on a pretty big portion of those bottles.
So that's how you can kind of tell if you're going to a liquor store, you turn it around and it says Indiana, it's probably mostly MGP.
Yeah, mostly. I mean, we have a couple kind of new smaller distilleries in Indiana that are great too, but yeah, 95% of everything that says
sure
distilled in Indiana on the back is probably going to come from us.
I love it. So the Ross and Squibb name, is that the original owners of the distillery?
So it's actually the first two distilleries that sit on our site. So the Rossville Union Distillery started all the way back in 1847. And that distillery would go operate through Prohibition. But then after Prohibition, they were actually starting back up and burnt down.
Hmm.
So at that time, the Seagram's Company came in out of Canada, bought the property, and rebuilt the distillery in the 30s. And that's still the distillery we're using to do the bulk of our distillation now.
Oh, cool.
Now, the Seagram's, I don't know if you're familiar with the Seagram's story, but like the third generation Bronfman wanted to get into movie pictures and bought Universal, kind of sold off the Seagram's assets. So in 2002, we got sold to Pernod Ricard, and we were a part of Pernod from 2002 to 2008.
Is that a watch brand?
Pernod?
Yeah.
No, Pernod's like the second biggest spirits company in the world.
What's that watch brand that started with a P?
Peugeot?
Yeah, I thought there's another one. But okay, so it's the second. Okay, I got
you.
Pernod Ricard.
Sorry, I threw a little wrench in there.
No, you're fine. No. So we were Pernod until 2008. In 2008, we were purchased by a holding company out of the Caribbean, and we operated under the moniker LDI, Lawrenceburg Distillers. Mm-hmm. And that was just from 2008 to 2011. In 2011, MGP purchased the distillery. And MGP purchased it really to make, they had already were in the contract distillation world, but they weren't into the brown goods, whiskeys and ryes. So we started getting into contract distillation of whiskeys. A few years in, I guess about... probably about 8-9 years ago, we purchased a very small brand in Cincinnati that was the Remus Bourbon brand. And they were already purchasing our bourbon for their brand, but we purchased the brand as our own about 10 years ago. And we started off really small, just kind of organically growing. We were only in a few states. And we also then started the Rossville Union Rye Whiskey brand shortly after that. Again, small organic growth. And then when we acquired Luxco a couple years ago, all of a sudden we have distribution in almost every state, really kind of refocused on our own brands. And then, I'm sorry, I totally skipped over the Squibb part of the distillery. So that Squibb part started in 1869. And that distillery was actually owned by George Remus during Prohibition, continued to operate during Prohibition, was owned by George Remus. And then after Prohibition, the Shenley Company bought it. So I don't know if you've ever heard of the Old Quaker brand. It's an old brand of whiskey, but it was the Old Quaker distillery for Shenley up until the 1980s when it shut down. And then we purchased that property in the 2010s, and we use those old Shenley rickhouses now for maturation. So it's all one continuous property, but originally it was two different distilleries.
How big is the property, like acreage-wise, do you know?
It's about a mile, little over a mile from north to south.
That's wild.
Yeah.
There's just so much good juice that comes out of these two distilleries that it's pretty sweet to see. So we have a lot of these brands in front of us, Remus and Rossville. When you're trying to take some stuff for your own, what is that process like? Like, do some companies have more seniority and say, I want this bottle, but you actually kind of want to, or barrel, and then you actually kind of want to keep some stuff for yourself? Like, how does that work?
So we sell whiskey in a lot of different ways. So so some companies will buy new make from us. Mm-hmm. So when we say new make, what they do is they'll purchase a contract and we'll lay down that whiskey for them. So it's theirs the day it's made. And we barrel it, we put it in our rickhouses, you know, they're going to pay storage fees to keep it in our rickhouses, and then whenever they're ready to dump that whiskey, we'll dump it for them. Mm-hmm. But then we also lay down a lot of whiskey for, we call it MGP put away. So that's going to be sold, to customers at a later date.
Sure.
You know, we're going to age that to increase the value of it and sell it as aged whiskey. So, and then we put away stuff for our own brands, and then that, you know, that's kind of a one pool, right? Mm-hmm. That whiskey for us. So then we can kind of decide from there, you know, what are we going to sell and what are we going to put into our own brands?
Gotcha. So when they reach out to you, if they did want you to distill it for them, mm-hmm. do they tell you a specific mash bill, or do you have mash bills that you consistently make that then goes to them?
It really depends on the customer.
Sure.
You know, we do a lot of different mash bills at the distillery. You know, for a distillery our size, we probably do more different things than anyone else.
Mm.
Typical, there's only a few distilleries our size. Typically, they're going to make, you know, anywhere between one and four different mash bills. You know, we're doing, you know, sometimes up to 30 different mash bills in a year. We do light whiskey. We do a ton of rye whiskey. We do, gin, GNS. We do a lot of different things. So it's very complex at the distillery. And, it's kind of managed on a customer by customer basis, you know, how that relationship works and what they're purchasing, you know, what we're doing for them.
How big, so like we know distance wise how large the distillery is, but like, do you know how much like equipment is inside? Like how many barrels are we talking?
So we don't say how many barrels specifically we have in inventory.
Sure.
I think what we officially say is we're one of the top five whiskey producers in the country.
So. That's crazy. So where do you get all this grain from if you're going to be, I don't know if you can get into that detail either, but like with how much you guys are producing, you have to have multiple sources because the amount of grain that you're consuming has to be so much.
Yeah. And we source our grains from different areas and we're pretty picky about what we bring in. Most of our rye will come from Germany and Sweden. So it comes from Europe. And we'll get pre-shipment samples. We'll select what grain we want to come over. It'll come over on a big ocean-going vessel into New Orleans. And then they'll send us pre-shipment samples of barges, and we'll select the holds out of that ship that we want. And
sure.
They'll get barged up to Louisville, then trucked to the distillery. For corn, we mostly source locally, within a couple hundred miles of the distillery.
Okay. I'm sure that makes it easier that you're not shipping the corn because, I mean, but you do have rye too, and all the rye is coming from overseas?
Not all of it.
Okay.
We've done a lot of experimentation with different rye over the last few years. So we've done some North American rye, but the bulk of our rye comes from Europe.
Is there an area, because within the United States and obviously within Europe, you have all these different climates that have rye grow differently. Mm-hmm. Is there a certain region that you prefer in the distillation process as opposed to others? Like New York rye is one of the big ones that is kind of taken off right now with that Empire Rye movement. But have you tried New York rye, or is there any other rye that would work better in your mash?
We have tried different ryes, and for us, we can't match our flavor profile with anything we've tried from North America.
Okay.
But we don't always have to match that flavor profile, right? There are other ryes, you know, are different and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But for the bulk of our distillation, we'll probably stick with that, the European rye, just because that's the flavor profile that we're really going for.
Sure.
For the bulk of what we do. But we play around with other things, you know, for one-offs and experimentation. We actually do a ton of experimentation into like the rye grain itself.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of started with identifying what compounds are responsible for the flavors you think of when you think of a rye whiskey, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like what makes that cinnamon and the clove and the baking spice? And then we trace those compounds back to their precursors in the grain. And then we started looking at, you know, methodology to test for those precursors in the grain. And we started looking at different varieties, what varieties are high in those compounds that we're looking for. And that's kind of helped guide us to sourcing different ryes.
Sure.
And experimentation. And then we also looked at, you know, what can we do in the distillery to really bring out those flavors to convert those precursors to those flavor compounds we're looking for.
Do you have like an internal science lab or something like that? Like where you're doing all this like chemical tracing? Because I think when you talk about whiskey, there's so many people of the population that have no idea of the back end process that goes into making it. Like, you just think that you have these cereal grains that can make a brown spirit after being put in a barrel, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, hearing you talk about the flavor profile that you're looking for in your rye whiskey is mostly coming from Europe. Like, talk us through how you even go about that. And first of all, what is the flavor profile that you're looking at, if you can kind of tease it to somebody that's never had your whiskey before? And then also, like, what is that process of actually figuring it out? Because that's fascinating.
So, yeah, we do have a large lab. We have a whole staff in our lab. But we also work with universities, too, to help with our research. And then we have a whole team of engineers. You know, I'm a chemical engineer myself. And we have a team of probably 6-7 engineers just always working on that kind of thing. And sorry, what was the full question?
Like, if someone hasn't had your products before, or MGP, or maybe they don't even know they're drinking MGP, like we were saying, it's not right there on the label. How would you classify your rye taste? You said clove and a little bit like that, but how would you classify your rye normally taste that you're looking for?
So the taste that I'm looking for in our ryes is, you know, that baking spice, the clove, cinnamon, kind of those traditional rye flavors. And then also our rye has kind of a unique mint note, and a lot of people get a dill note. So, like, my favorite ryes from the distillery are the ones that are really heavy in that mint and dill, but also have that traditional rye flavors as well.
Is it your favorite because you don't normally get that note from somewhere else?
I think it's my favorite just because that's what I like.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. It is. I do think it's a little bit unique to our distillery. I have had some ryes not made at our distillery that have been pretty minty. But that dill note, I've never really found in a rye elsewhere.
I got to start searching for it, because now if we try a rye here and I'm going to, like, be thinking about it, it's going to be like, you know, as soon as you start telling people what you taste, it's like, oh yeah, I taste that too. But I'm going to have to try to see if you can pick that up, because that's, I don't know if I've tasted a dill in a rye whiskey before.
Yeah, I didn't bring any of our ryes that are really heavy in that mint and dill note. Kind of brought more of our bourbons for today, but I can definitely tell you where to go to find that.
Yeah, direct me in that. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of the stuff here. So the Remus brand and the Ross brand, they haven't always been around, or have they?
No, so the Remus brand, we started about 8-9 years ago. We purchased it about 8-9 years ago. And then the Rossville Union Rye brand came maybe 2 or 3 years after that.
So just to recap, you purchased the Remus brand, but the Remus brand was already using your juice anyway, right?
Yes, that's correct. And it was real small, kind of local Cincinnati brand.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So was that had to have been an easy transition then, because then you're not only, like, having that brand consistency, you're not changing the juice drastically, right? Like, did you just use that same stuff that you've always been providing them to continue the brand going forward?
No, I would say there was a pretty big step up in quality when we when we started filling those bottles.
Interesting. So can we go through some of these? What's the first one that you have? Is there one that you want to start with?
Yeah, we can start with our everyday bourbon. Okay. So this is our 94 proof Remus. It's a blend between two kind of historic mash bills we've been doing at the distillery since the 1930s, and that's our LESV and our LBSV. So that's our 21% rye bourbon and our 36% rye bourbon.
Okay.
So it's 75% corn, 21% rye, 4% malted barley, and 60% corn, 36% rye, 4% malted barley. And we've been doing these mash bills at the distillery for a really long time. The barrels I picked for this are going to be 5 and 6 years, and it's at 94 proof. It's a little more, you know, obviously it's very rye forward, you know, much higher rye content than you're going to find in some of the traditional Kentucky bourbons. And it's just a little more floral, a little more spicy, not quite as sweet vanilla caramel as like a traditional Kentucky bourbon. And we're in a pretty unique position right now because our brands are pretty small, but we're a very large distillery and we have a lot of barrels, so we can be extremely selective in what barrels we're putting into our own brands.
Do you do a lot of small batch stuff, like in general at the distillery? Because I feel like when you start getting into small batch, then you have the ability to introduce a little bit more or less consistency within each batch. Mm-hmm. So is there, do you have a set number of barrels that you normally use for the brand, or is it just whatever fits that flavor?
It's whatever fits that flavor. Sure. Like we're not trying, we're hitting a flavor profile with our 94 proof. It's going to be, you know, hopefully the mm-hmm. same experience every time you go buy that sure. bottle. But we do small, pretty small batches, in terms of all these products. You know, with our Rossville, the last bottling of our kind of mainline Rossville rye was about 82 bottles or 82 barrels. Sorry. So they're fairly small batches. Yes.
That's awesome. You want to try some?
Yeah.
Or can I try some?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is that 94 proof Remus. Start with that.
Awesome. Of course he does. So 5 and 6 year, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
5 and 6. So when you're taking it out of the barrel for your bourbon, what are you looking for to see if it's ready? Like, why did you choose 5 and 6 year?
I mean, really just, you know, every barrel is going to be different in terms of when you're going to pull it. So we look at barrels that are kind of have matured, or we would say they've matured pretty early for 5 and 6 year for the Remus 94. And then those barrels that we see that we think are going to continue to get better as they mature, we'll hold on to for some of our allocated releases sure. with like the Repeal and the Gatsby. So actually, like it's pretty easy. Like I work with our master blender, and I say it's easy, but I lean on him pretty heavily. It's pretty easy. Like the 5 and 6 year, and then the Repeal is extremely easy to blend. It's actually those higher ages that are really difficult because it's hard to watch these barrels as they age and pick the right ones to keep and hold on to some of those higher age sure. statement bourbons. Yeah.
What is the highest age statement that you have?
It's our Gatsby Reserve, this one here. So 15? It's a 15, yeah.
Because yeah, that's got to be tough. Like, this tastes so good now, but do I want to wait
mm-hmm.
and keep it yeah. for another 9 years?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, cheers, man.
Yeah,
thank cheers. You.
And usually, like, the ones that are going to go into this maybe weren't that great at 5 and 6 years old. You know, usually, like, the barrel that's going to be best at 15 usually wasn't the best at 5 or 6, sure. right?
That's really good. It's very sweet, and it tingles the sides of your tongue.
Yeah, thank you. We, like I said, we can be really picky with what we're putting into this just because of how many barrels we have yeah. versus the size of our brands. You know, they're still
it's very caramely. Infancy.
Yeah, it's a little less caramely than some of the Kentucky bourbons. Just a little more floral, but it definitely has that caramel mm-hmm. in it still. I mean, it's still, you know, a lot of corn in those.
So do you take influence from, when you say floral and MGP kind of having that gin background, do you take some of the influence from there to try to figure out if there's a floral note that resonates well with the gin that's been produced and try to get that replicated in whiskey at all, or no?
No, not really.
Yeah.
It's usually pretty different notes mm-hmm. in the gin and yeah. the whiskeys. You know, we do sensory on everything we make. So like every morning, kind of the first thing I do is I go into the distillery. We'll have our morning meeting, kind of talk about the goals for the day. But after that, the next thing I do is go to our sensory lab, and we'll have all the distillates that we made from the previous day on a table. A lot of them we'll just have lettered, and then we'll have to pick out, you know, what we made in those distillates versus the standard of kind of like what is that standard that sure. we're trying to hit. So we do that with our gins, with our whiskeys, with even with the GNS. And so I think that probably helps us be a little more well-rounded mm-hmm. Just because we are constantly looking at all those flavor profiles from all the different spirits. when we're blending, but it's not something that I've ever really consciously thought about.
This really doesn't taste like a 90, 94 proof at all. Like, this goes down so much. Like, you get, when I associate a higher proof, I mean, this is still 94, so we're not talking like super high proof at all, but normally I start feeling it like in the middle of my chest, and here I just, it really, it's only like tingling the sides of my tongue. Like, this is very, very well made to where I don't feel bad drinking more of it, I guess, if that makes sense. But like, that 94 proof goes down very, very light.
Thank you. That's what we're going for. We're trying to impress. So I appreciate that.
The label behind it, one of the things that we do for our weekly whiskey reviews is we look at label branding and try to figure out, does it stand out on the shelf? What's the bottle like? What's the cork like? Is it a real cork? Is it a synthetic cork? When designing the bottle of the Remus brand, is that consistent from when it was previously, the other, before you acquired it?
No, it's changed a few times.
Sure.
So it was different before we acquired it. When we acquired it, we changed the packaging again. And then we actually just recently overhauled all of our packaging once more. So this bottle here is fairly new. The old bottle actually had a George Remus's face on it, like his kind of silhouette with a hat on.
Nice.
So this, we kind of changed it to look more Art Deco, to kind of match the packaging of the Gatsby and the Repeal. The Gatsby and the Repeal have just gotten a ton of good publicity and attention over the last couple of years. So we really wanted to make that connection a little tighter.
The Gatsby kind of looks, and we'll talk about it, but the Gatsby kind of looks like cognac vibes to it.
Yeah. It's a fancy bottle. We wanted to really play on that Art Deco look with the bottle, and I think our marketing team did a pretty great job with that.
So you personally, I know that this is probably going to open up a can of worms, but what is your favorite type of whiskey? Are you a rye guy? Are you a bourbon guy? And like, of your mash bills that you create, what do you normally tend to go to when you go to a store and you pick something off the shelf?
So I'm a rye whiskey person, like very wholeheartedly. I love bourbon, but rye whiskey is my first love and will always be my love. And when I go home, you know, after working at the distillery all day, I'm usually reaching for our rye whiskey.
How many different blends of mash bills of rye whiskey do you guys make?
Ooh, I mean, really, there's two main ones. So the two main ones are 95% rye, 5% malted barley. That's probably the mash bill our distillery is most famous for. And that would be the predominant mash bill we make as far as rye whiskey goes. We also do our 51% or 51% rye, 45% corn, 4% malted barley, which is a little bit more of a bourbon drinker's rye, a little sweeter with that corn. And we do a pretty fair amount of that as well. But then we've, over the years, have done, you know, probably dozens of other kind of one-offs or maybe just very small volumes.
I've always been curious too, because you see a lot of the like 95.5, you see 51, 49 or 46 or sometimes 49. What is there a combination that doesn't work in your opinion? Like 75 rye and like, is there a percentage between 51 and 95 that just doesn't work for you?
No, I don't think so. I haven't like found that, yeah, each one's just going to be different.
Sure.
But I mean, I really enjoy our 95.5. We actually, one of the ones I brought for you to taste today is actually a different mash bill. It's 51 rye, 49 barley malt.
Hmm.
And that's a totally different experience than any of our other ryes.
That one is bottled and bonded, and I guess we'll kind of transition to that one. What is that process like to have it bottled and bond? I think that you're the... It might be the first distillery that we've interviewed that has makes their own stuff that is bottled in bond. So what is all this whiskey technically bottled in bond if it's been 4 years in 100 proof?
No, because a lot of, like, this is 5- and 6-year-old. This is 9-, 10-, and 16-year-old. So there are different vintages. With bottled in bond, it has to be distilled in the same season. So the barrels have to be distilled in the same season, yeah.
So... The whole rickhouse or warehouse, though, is bonded, right? Like, you're not making a certain area of the rickhouse bonded?
No, all the rickhouses are bonded.
Okay.
And basically, that's just So you don't pay the excise tax up front when you're aging it. You'll pay that excise tax, you know, later when it's bottled and at retail.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So anything that we didn't cover in that straight bourbon whiskey that you want to get out, I mean, it's a gorgeous bottle. Can you find that at Addie's?
Yeah, they're bringing it in here. So they're bringing it in this month. Yeah. I don't know when you're going to air this.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. So when this comes out, it should be here. Okay. Do you roundabout know what price it's going to be released for at all?
$40.
$40? Wow. What?
Yeah.
Great price for that.
Yeah. Thanks.
So when you're looking at prices, we always say that kind of that $50 mark is when you start competing with a lot of higher end whiskeys. Mm-hmm. And coming in at $40, I mean, that's a steal for this product. This is probably one of your more entry level products. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yeah. Right. This would be our entry level bourbon.
And that's the one that's probably most available, even not in New York State. Like, do you have an area on a website or something where somebody can look up and see if that's available in a liquor store near them?
Yeah, we actually do. If you just go to our website, Remus Bourbon, there's a store locator there that can help you out.
Cool. You want to go to the raw stuff? We can grab a dump bucket too if you want. Well, I don't know if you want to dump it. I don't know if that's like sacrilegious or something. I'm really excited to try this brand because I've always thought about the prospect of MGP having their own, or branches of MGP having their own product. And just being an outsider looking in, it always thought, like, my first thought was, is there going to be conflict? Like, because you have MGP making stuff for other brands, and is there going to be ever any conflict between different brands and you wanting to make your own stuff? Obviously, that's clearly not happening, right? Have you had any pushback from any brands at all?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, the industry is still, you know, rising, and and everybody in this industry is just super friendly. Like, there's no like cutthroat competition in this industry. You know, we go do events together. I see, you know, people from other distilleries all the time. You know, I have friends that I used to work with at MGP that have moved on to other distilleries. And, you know, if I'm going to be in town, I call them up. They'll invite me to go come to the distillery and hang out. And, you know, everybody in this industry is in it together.
Sure. That's awesome. All right. You want to try this one?
Yeah. So this is a pretty new product. So really brand new product. And it's our 6-year bottled and bond Rossville Union. So it's 51% rye, 49% malted barley. And it's very different than any of the other rye mash bills we do because of that.
So no corn in here at all. It's 51 and 49 malted barley.
Yeah. And the reason we kind of originally did this mash bill is because I was telling you a little bit earlier about, you know, we were looking at how do we extract those flavor components in the rye that are the precursors for the chemicals in the rye that are the precursors for those flavor components we're looking for in the rye whiskey. And one of the things we found is that a lot of them are bound up in complexes in the rye that are really hard to break down. And the best way to break those complexes down and free those compounds into solution so that the yeast can metabolize them into those flavor compounds you're looking for is to hit them with a lot of endogenous enzymes from a malted grain, like malted barley. So it's very malted barley forward on the nose. You get a lot of that like grass and chocolate from the malted barley on the nose, but then that rye flavor really, really dominates on the palate because of that.
It's just got to be so fun to tinker with some of this stuff. Being such a large distillery that you guys are, I'm sure that there was countless research that went into this, fun research, I might say, but like there has to have been so much research to figure out what percentage of that enzyme, because I mean, you can't just, you have malted barley and then you have malted rye. Was there ever any consideration of bringing that malted rye into a rye whiskey at all?
We've considered that. We've played around with that a little bit, but for this mash bill, we went with the malted barley.
Ooh, that's kind of a unique taste, but that is a very unique mash bill, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know if I've ever heard of a 5149 malted barley. Because normally you get some of that corn in there, which to me, like, I'm with you. Corn is, or rye whiskey is my favorite. I'm actually more of a single malt guy myself. But, like, rye whiskey if in the America side is definitely my favorite. Because the corn, for me, I feel like sometimes can take away from some of that amazing taste from the flavoring grain, like a rye. Like, a really well-flavored rye whiskey is just amazing to me. And having 51% rye and not introducing that corn is fantastic.
Yeah, I like this a lot. I'm with you where rye can, to me, can just be so much more complex mm-hmm. than corn. And what we found, too, is that every different variety of rye produces a totally different rye whiskey. Where, we've done a lot with different varietals of corn. And, some people might not agree with me, but corn is kind of corn to me. We've played around with different varieties of corn and sometimes they're fun, but we did stuff with blue corn and all of our fermenters were purple and that was fun. But at the end of the day, to me, from a flavor profile, corn is kind of corn.
I'm so happy that you said that because when you talk about MGP and you talk about whiskey and bourbon, there's a lot of that goes into corn, and hearing you say that, It's corn. It's kind of refreshing from me to hear from someone like you that, like, rye whiskey is very complex. Have you done anything with any malt, like single malt at all?
We've experimented. I don't know when those things might come to the market, but we've experimented with some.
Nice.
Things, yeah.
Love to hear that. Mm-hmm. So this is 6 years. This is bottled in bond. We talked a little bit about it, but can you go into the requirements from a distillation standpoint? What constitutes a bottled in bond product?
Yeah, it's just your typical, from a distillation standpoint, it's just going to be distilled like a bourbon, right? Mm-hmm. So below 160 proof, barreled no more than 125 or below 125. And then, it has to be at least 4 years old, no additives, which is kind of bourbon anyway, mm-hmm. or is bourbon anyway, and then bottled at 100 proof. So it really was created and then stored in bonded warehouse. Sure. So it was really created because, back in the day when the Bottled in Bond Act happened, there was just a lot of adulteration of whiskey. So it was really just a label you could put on there to show that it was pure whiskey, unadulterated. Sure. Had spent its good time in the barrel and came from, one distillery.
Sure. That's pretty sweet. Yeah, that 100 proof going up from that 94, you're still getting such a good burn in your mouth, but it doesn't travel. And sometimes distillers plan for that travel. Like, they want it to hug you down here. They want it mm-hmm. you to feel it in your stomach. From your perspective, is that ever a experience you're trying to get people to experience, is getting that deeper burn, or do you always want it to kind of stay within like a higher hug?
No, I think that finish and that burn is going to be different for each of our products.
Okay.
And, that when we're blending, that's a huge consideration. It's aroma, palate, finish, mm-hmm. right? We're looking at every aspect of that experience when we're blending.
Sure.
But this with that malted barley, the enzymes in the malted barley bring out that rye flavor, but it also softens up that rye spice just a little bit, right?
100%.
Like it softens it up a little bit, and it's not quite as deep of a burn as you're going to get in some of our other Rossville whiskeys, like our Barrel Proof, which is predominantly the 95% rye, 5% malted barley mash bill.
I feel like, too, with this being at such a low rye, but all of the rest of it being a malted product, you get a more a different experience of a rye finish note that you don't get with a rye product that has corn in it or something that's kind of masking the ending note. Because I'm getting much more of that rye flavor. Is it still lingering in my mouth after I've already like taken a sip and put the glass to the side? Because I think that it has to do with the fact that there's so much malted barley in it and there's no other flavoring grain or any corn in there. I think this is fantastic. And obviously Addie's will have this in, or we'll be having this in once this goes live, but do we know a price on this at all? Not yet. This is a fantastic product. I think that this is probably... It's a different rye than what I've had before. And I mean, that has to do with the malted barley.
Yeah, we wanted something different with mm-hmm. this. You know, we have our kind of traditional rye in our Rossville Union line as well. We have a 94 proof Rossville Union that is 5 and 6 year old, just like the 94 proof Remus. And that's a blend of our 95% rye, 5% malted barley, and our 51% rye, 45 corn, 4% malted barley, kind of those two bigger mash mm-hmm. bills we do. And it's the majority of it is that 95.5, but we put quite a bit of that 45 corn in there as well to make it, it's kind of our approachable rye. You know, it's got some of that corn sweetness sure. in it. It's a good transition for bourbon drinkers, but it's complex enough for rye drinkers too. And then we have our barrel proof, which the barrels I pick for that are all at least 7 years old. And that's that big, minty, dilly, like rye drinker's rye. That's what I'm reaching for when I go home
sure.
in the morning or in the afternoon.
In the morning. I will say, though, this isn't an unapproachable rye at all. Like you said, that corn added to it makes it a little bit more approachable. This is extremely approachable. You're not getting a lot of rye burn from this at all.
No, that's that malted barley.
Right.
It just kind of, yeah, it just softens it up a little bit. Makes it a little more kind of grassy, cereally, chocolatey.
Sure. Mm-hmm. This is fantastic. I appreciate this.
Thanks.
I don't want to keep drinking so much. You know, we got to drive home after this. But obviously, we have to try these other ones, though. So we went from the straight bourbon that is kind of your entry-level main steak. That's our bourbon product. This rye is a little bit more intricate. Like, it's still approachable for individuals. What else do we have here? We have the Gatsby, the 6 year, and the repeal. So kind of tell us a little story about the Gatsby version and what is this supposed to portray?
So the Gatsby's are 15 year. It's a kind of our top end product. It's those same two bourbon mash bills that are in our everyday 94 proof Remus. But the barrels I picked for this are going to be all at least 15 years old. So it's difficult to blend because we're doing all that work before mm-hmm. we're actually blending it, right? We're trying to pick out those barrels that are going to be good at 15 years old. Because I'd say a high percentage of our barrels are not going to be good at 15 years old. They're sure. going to be over-oaked. They're going to be kind of that bitter, tannic, you know. So we got to pick out what's going to be good, what's going to keep getting better to that age.
Sure.
And then the reason we do kind of the Gatsby Reserve and the Art Deco packaging is because of George Remus, the person. So George Remus was a bootlegger during Prohibition. He grew up in Chicago, and his uncle owned a pharmacy. And from a very young age, he worked at the pharmacy. By the time he was 18 years old, he'd put himself through pharmacy school and purchased the pharmacy from his uncle. And, you know, he was very ambitious. He got bored being a teenager pharmacist, so he decided to go to law school as well, or put himself through law school. By the time he was 21 years old, he had put himself through law school and passed the bar. So he was a pharmacist Jeez. And an attorney by 21. And
what?
Yeah, I was still like in my parents' basement, but
yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, so he started representing bootleggers early on in Prohibition as an attorney, and he thought, these guys are just kind of dumb hillbillies, you know. They're making a ton of money, but I could do this better.
Sure.
So he moved down to Cincinnati, just close by to our distillery, and he started buying up distilleries and buying up pharmacies. And what he would do is he'd get medicinal permits to pull whiskey out of the warehouses of his distilleries, and then he would sell that under medicinal license at his pharmacies.
Sure.
But he realized that there was a lot bigger market to capitalize on, so he started pulling whiskey out of the warehouses under medicinal permits. And then as those trucks would leave his warehouses, he would have his own guys rob his own guys and take that whiskey out to a farm outside of Cincinnati they called Death Valley Farm. And bootleggers from all over the country would come pick up the whiskey there. He was the biggest volume bootlegger during Prohibition. So then he would get more permits to pull more whiskey out because his whiskey was stolen from him.
Sure.
And yeah, he quickly became very, very wealthy. And he liked to show off that wealth. He was very flashy with his wealth. They would write about his extravagant parties in the national news. There was one specific party they wrote about in the Cincinnati Inquirer where every man in attendance had a diamond stick pin by their placemat at dinner. And the women were looking around like, what do we get? And the servants came around with little wood boxes, and every woman in attendance had keys to a new car in a little wood box. And the servants pulled the cars up the driveway. And he was just known for these super extravagant parties. And the legend is that he met F. Scott Fitzgerald in the basement of the Seelbach Hotel. They became kind of drinking buddies, and it's very likely that he was the inspiration for Jay Gatsby of The Great Gatsby. That's why we have our Gatsby Reserve.
That's sweet. And what a cool story.
And he ties into our distillery specifically because he owned the Squibb Distillery during Prohibition, and it was actually barrels from the Squibb Distillery that eventually got him caught and locked up.
That's an amazing story. I'm surprised I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, it is a really, really interesting story. He was a very interesting character during Prohibition, and you know he's local to us. He owned our distillery, so it's an interesting connection and piece of history.
So obviously, that story has to be on a 15-year-old product.
Yeah,
that's so cool. So when you're going through, we talked about this a little bit earlier. When you're tasting juice from the barrel, and you're saying it's not quite ready yet. I want to save this for an older product, maybe this Gatsby. But at that point, when it's 5 years or 6 years old, you don't necessarily know if it's going to be good in 15. So are you tasting?
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Every year to see how it's evolving, or are you just putting it in a corner and saying this will be good at 15 years?
No, we do barrel surveys every year.
Okay.
So our master blender and his team will do those barrel surveys every year, and then they'll keep me in the loop. You know, I work really closely with our master blender for the blending of our own brands, the Remus and the Rossville. So he keeps a good eye on all that. You know, I'll taste along with him. You know, I won't do the full barrel survey with him because I have to do other things as well. But no, we keep a good eye on how everything's maturing.
So this one says cask strength too. What is it coming out at?
It's 98.1 proof.
Okay.
So a lot of people see that and they're like, how is it cask strength at 98.1? So our barrel entry proof is a little bit lower than most. We do 120. So we're not the lowest out there, but you know, a lot of people are 124.99.
Sure.
So our entry proof is a little lower. And then our distillery sits right where Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana meet. And it's in the Ohio River Valley. And it's right where Tanner's Creek, the little creek, empties into the Ohio. And they sit down low in that riverbed, and it's just very humid.
Hmm.
And the partial pressure of water in the air being higher slows down the evaporation rate of water. So our barrels tend to go down in proof as they age.
That's fascinating, because normally it's the other way around.
Yeah, and you know, we could throw a rock from our distillery and be in Kentucky, where a lot of the proofs skyrocket. It's just that little microclimate we sit in the riverbed. It's interesting. We actually have a levee system that is around the town of Lawrenceburg and Greendale, but it's really almost exclusively around the distillery. And the levee walls are actually, the rick houses are part of the levee walls. It's actually built into the creek. So it's just very humid there, and you get that proof typically goes down. But we do see some locations go up. We also have offsite warehousing.
Mm.
So we have a couple locations. We have a location in Indiana as well as in Kentucky. So the profile and the proof will be a little different out of those rick houses, which gives us more options to blend with.
That's fascinating. The whole difference in climate, and again, we talked about this a little earlier, when people don't necessarily understand the chemical makeup that makes up whiskey. Also, the barometric pressure and the humidity and all that stuff changes so much in the product. I never would have thought that it can decrease what's in the cask by that much for a 15-year-old product. That's pretty sweet. So when So you're not diluting that, obviously. When you dilute the 94 and the 100, obviously 100 is bottled and bond, so you have to dilute it to that. But when you're diluting it to the 47, are you using, like, what is your diluting process for that?
I mean, it's just typical. We use, we're going to use demineralized water. And we don't do, like, the slow proofing or anything like that. It's just going to be, you know, proofing down with demineralized water to hit that bottling proof.
Are you using the same casks for all this stuff, too? For the most part?
Kind of, for the most part. Our standard is four-char staves with two-char heads. And we predominantly work with ISC and Speyside. But over the years, you know, if I go and look at our inventory, we have dozens of different Coopers barrels in inventory. We've played around with lower chars, you know, with heavy toasts, with, you know, longer aged, longer season staves. We've done pretty much everything over the years, but most of the whiskey that's going to go into all these was going to be four char staves with two char heads.
So that 4 and 2, is that common that you have two different char levels on the different parts of the barrel?
I actually don't know the answer to that. I don't know what all the other distilleries do specifically. That's been the way we've been doing it at our distillery for a very long time, and that kind of gives us the profile we like. I'm not sure. I know what a couple of the other bigger guys do, but I don't know what everyone does.
And this, it could be common, but that's the first time that I've heard using two different chars in the same barrel. So what makes the head so much different that you're using a different char on that?
I think it just gives us that profile we're looking for. So in general, the lower the char, the more flavor you're going to pick up early on, the more color you're going to pick up overall. So a lot of people think like the color comes from the char, but the char really acts like a charcoal filter. Mm-hmm. Like your Brita water filter doesn't add color, right? I hope not.
That'd be weird.
Actually the higher char level, the less color it imparts. So that char really helps kind of filter out any off notes. Mm-hmm. And then with those heads being lower char, it helps kind of pick up some of that color and some of that flavor a little quicker than you would if the whole thing was four char.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I don't even know that you could do that. So you just talk to ISC and you're like, hey, I want this?
Yeah, I mean, we use a lot of different Coopers, but that's what we specify when we're purchasing barrels.
Can I try a little bit of that one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I, 15-year... So from we talked about what your favorite mash bill is, and you said that you like rye. Do you have a specific proof point that you like to, that you normally gravitate towards?
I typically like cask strength.
Okay.
And I think there's a lot of kind of misinformation in the community about proof. You know, kind of the hot thing is like high proof and the higher the better, right? Mm-hmm. So like people like those hazmat bottles. But I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding that cask strength is cask strength. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, 130 proof is not more flavorful than 106 proof if they're both cask strength.
Sure.
Like you're getting the full flavor. You're not diluting with any water. And the ethanol is not giving you flavor. You know, I could take 193 proof off of our rectifiers and add it to this bottle to make it very high proof, and it would be very unflavorful, mm-hmm. right? Because that 193 proof has no flavor.
Sure.
So I think it's kind of this weird misconception that higher proof is better when really people just want cask strength. They want something that hasn't been watered down at all. I don't know. I think it's interesting. There will be changes at different proofs in the barrel. So as that barrel spends more time at a higher proof, maybe it will extract more alcohol solubles from the barrel than water solubles, and vice versa. But really, I kind of don't understand this trend of like the hazmats and stuff. I'm not. I don't fully understand it.
I feel like it has to do a lot with like guys being like, yeah, I can handle it. It's like, come on. It's not that cool. Because even when you're drinking a 94 proof, you're tasting a product from an expert that feels like adding this amount of water makes this whiskey taste the best. So I remember I was talking to this guy and he's like, I don't drink anything under 110. It's like, all right, guy, chill out, because there's some really good whiskeys that are 90 proof, that are 100 proof. And yeah, I'm right there with you. And again, I love that you're having this open conversation around corn tasting the same and the proof not necessarily mattering. Like, it does matter for some aspects of it, but there's a lot of good whiskey throughout the whole gamut from 80 all the way up to, I think I saw 150 once. It's, the proof doesn't necessarily matter. It's just that's how it's meant to be tasted. That's all.
Yeah, and you don't really see all the time. I mean, the proofs are intentional, and yes, they're made by experts. You know, the blenders in our business do a phenomenal job. You know, our master blender, Sam Schmelzer, does an incredible job. I love working with him on this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it is intentional, but also like the specific proof too, you have no idea how much water was added.
Sure.
So like, you know, if our average barrels coming out were at 135 proof and it was 94 proof at bottling, that would be a much different experience than, you know, if they started at 105 and went to 94.
Sure.
Right? So that the absolute proof really isn't important unless you're just looking to get drunk.
Yeah, right. And there's the community. You said the community of distillers that you've interacted with are very, like, nice people. You haven't really experienced that. So I think there's also a misnomer of people thinking that if it's 80, that's a distillery that is trying to get the most bang for their buck and add as much water to it as possible to get the most yield of the product. But I don't really see that existing within the industry either, where distilleries are purposely trying to get as much for as much yield from their barrels for like by making their product taste worse by making it 80 proof. Like, that doesn't exist, I don't feel like.
Yeah, I would say that probably exists a little bit in the very value bourbons, right? Like the really cheap bourbons, they're at that lower proof intentionally to stretch the cases out. Sure. I think, and because maybe their customer likes that kind of lighter flavor profile. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anything that's in a glass bottle is probably intentionally there, right?
Sure.
Like, it's, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to get a few more cases and risk our flavor profile.
Sure.
It doesn't make any sense because these are really luxury items at this point. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the margins are good. They're where they're at. We don't need to stretch a couple cases out. That's kind of not what we would do.
Sure. So this 15 Gatsby is the same mash bill as this, just older, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
This is very, if you were to put both those in front of me, I would obviously probably gravitate more towards that 15, but this is fantastic coming out. I think now I'm getting more of that floral. This is a good product.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, our older bourbons kind of pick up like this, like cherry cola type of flavor.
Hmm.
You know, this one's very heavy on the oak, where this is going to be a little more of that cherry cola. Some people call it a medicinal cherry or sure. a cherry cola, but they're
cough syrup.
Our older bourbons pick up this kind of unique cherry flavor. And this one, I think has a good amount of it. And then it's really heavy on the oak, kind of those like darker barrel mm-hmm. notes, like the leather kind of tobacco flavors is what we're typically going for with this.
With this too, I'm getting a little bit more of a like a coagulation in the back of my mouth. Again, mm-hmm. it's all staying within the mouth, which is an amazing experience, but you're getting more of that salivation as it like the back of your tongue.
Yeah, I think that those oak tannins kind of bring out that salivation. These are like, you know, I love this whiskey, and it couldn't be another year old. Like, mm-hmm. those tannins are getting so strong, they're right on the border of starting to turn bitter, but sure. they haven't yet. And that, I think that kind of makes you salivate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. We're just about like at an hour. Do you still have time? Are you still okay?
Yeah, we're still good.
All right. Yeah. I mean, this is, so far, this is probably my favorite, which is weird because we talked about I like the rye a lot. But this, I feel like the mouthfeel, the entire experience is definitely justifying that 15-year-old age on that, because this is just a very, this is a great experience for this product.
Thank you. We appreciate that. We put a lot of work into it, so we appreciate it.
And I mean, I love the Gatsby. The whole vibe of that and the other one is just, it's a really cool, it's a cool, like, you can even turn this once you're done with it into a, like, a water or decanter. Like, this is a cool product just to have on your shelf.
We actually talked to somebody like an hour ago that said the exact same
thing. Oh, really?
Yeah. They said, I like to turn some of my bottles into decanters, and this would be a really cool decanter.
It's sweet. It's really cool. Yeah. So this next one is a highest rye straight bourbon whiskey. And all these products will eventually be at Addie's at some point. Is that the goal for these?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And this one will be here in like a month. So this should be here, you know, potentially by the time this airs.
So the highest rye bourbon, is that the same that you were talking about a little earlier with the 36 rye? Is that what you're, no?
Different? No. Okay. So that 21% rye and 36% rye, those were Seagram's recipes we've been doing for ages and ages.
Gotcha.
This is a brand new recipe. So this recipe, you know, is exclusive right now to this bottle. We did do a couple of our single barrel picks with this recipe, but other than that, we haven't released this recipe anywhere. So this is 51 corn, 39 rye, 10% malted rye. So we kind of really pioneered high rye bourbon. That style was kind of unique to us for a long time. And so when we were looking at creating a new bourbon recipe, we wanted to push that rye influence to the max. And it's the first bourbon recipe we've done with malted rye too, which adds a little unique character. So we've been kind of, I'm really excited about this one. Me and our master blender have been kind of monitoring these barrels over the last 6 years, and we thought this year was finally the year to break it out. You know, we tasted it at quite a few different proofs. We knew we wanted it to be higher. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of the trend. So we tasted it, I think we started at like 103, went to about 112, and we settled in at that 109. And what I love about this mash bill is that it's not what you think it's going to be.
True.
So you hear that 49% rye bourbon, like the most rye you can have in a bourbon, and you think like that rye is really going to hit you in the face, like it's almost going to be like a boar rye. And it, that at the front of the palate, it's like all brown sugar and sweetness, which like doesn't even really make sense.
Sure.
But then that rye really like starts to slowly creep in on the back of the palate, and it almost turns into like a ginger snap cookie type of flavor. I couldn't be more happy with the way these turned out.
I don't know if it's just because you told me that, but this is the sweetest, highest rye bourbon on the front that I've tasted in a very long time. It doesn't even feel like there's rye in it until halfway through, and you're like, okay, there it is. It's, again, it's in the back of your tongue where you're starting to get a little bit of that like prickliness, where that rye is starting to show through. But the way that it presents itself on the front of your tongue is so like well-rounded, where there's no peaks and valleys. It's just kind of this like sweetness that you're tasting and you're like, oh, okay, whoa, there you go. That's a really cool, product.
Yeah, it's almost, in the front, it's like kind of, like I said, brown sugar, and it's almost kind of like syrupy, like maple syrupy, and then that rye spice just kind of comes in softly at first, and by the end you're like, yeah, it's there. Yeah,
it leaves like this weird, not weird, but like this interesting coating on your tongue, which I don't know if it's an actual coating or if it's just a like a sweet experience that your back, your tongue is making you feel like it's a coating because it just went over your tongue so quickly.
Yeah. And we also, sorry, Jeff, what's going to be the price on this one?
$50 on the shelf.
So this is going to be $50 on the shelf. So a 6-year age stated product from our distillery, and a mash at high proof, at 109 proof, and a mash bill that people haven't experienced from us before at $50. You know, I fought pretty hard to keep that price low on this, and I think it's going to really, we've already gotten a lot of good feedback on it.
Yeah.
It's been going really well so far, but I think the whiskey community is really going to like this, especially at that price point.
Yeah, for sure. So when you're going into liquor stores and you're trying to sell the Remus brand, are you going in saying that this is like an MGP family product, or are you like, what is your sales pitch for the Remus brand in trying to differentiate it from other MGP source products on the market?
Yeah. I mean, we lead with that, right? We're proud of who we are. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think our reputation has really grown over, the last 10 years. I've been at the distillery about 10 years. You know, when I first started, people that were buying our whiskeys weren't necessarily being really transparent mm-hmm. about it. And it was kind of like the dirty secret. But then, over the years, people have become more and more transparent about it. Our reputation for making incredible whiskeys has really grown. So now it's almost like front and center for some of our customers' marketing. They're like, sure. We got these MGP barrels, they're going to be good. Come get them, right? So when I'm talking to retailers and consumers about our products, I really want them to understand. It's more educating them about, like, sometimes they think like Remus and Rossville are NDPs, like, and that they're sourcing from MGP. I'm like, no, we are MGP.
Right.
Like, we are MGP, and this is what we think our best foot forward is. Like these are our brands. We're doing really, smaller limited runs that we're being incredibly picky about what mm-hmm. we put into these. This is like the best of what MGP has to offer.
That's really cool because, going back to what we talked about earlier with MGP being so prevalent in the market, that having product that is coming directly from MGP itself is, I think, what people have been looking for a while, because there's all these brands that they've tried. We're not going to name any names, but all these brands that they've tried that are coming from Indiana, that are coming from MGP, and there comes a point where it's like, okay, what am I actually getting? Am I getting MGP product? Am I getting their version of MGP? And I think that this is very, very a good value, but also something that everybody has to try to understand. This is MGP at its core, which is a great experience that people need to try.
Yeah, this is what MGP thinks MGP right. should be.
That's really sweet. But it's just now getting people to understand that Remus, like the brand name, is this. Mm-hmm. So that's like, what other marketing is there available? Is there social media? Is there, like, how are you getting the message across?
Yeah, we have kind of a loyalty club, the King Circle. We're on Facebook as Remus Bourbon, as Ross and Squibb, as Rossville Union. We have social media on Facebook and Instagram for both of those. Mm-hmm. We have websites for Ross and Squibb, for Remus, for Rossville. And then we're putting a lot of marketing behind these brands. We just had our first commercial for Remus earlier this year with the Indianapolis 500. It's like Indiana's oldest race meets Indiana's oldest distillery. Nice. It was kind of a cool partnership. We're also doing some stuff, out in the community. We're partnering with Water Boys, which Chris Long, it's his foundation. Mm. And we actually just completed a well in Africa for a community that didn't have clean drinking water. Water is such an important part of making whiskey. We're very lucky. We sit on top of the Great Miami River Buried Valley Aquifer, and it's a really great source of sand and limestone filtered water. The mineral content in it is very good for yeast health and fermentation. There's some other big brewing and distilling facilities on top of that aquifer. We pull about 8 million gallons of water out of the ground every day. We don't touch the water table. We're very lucky. Yeah, every day. Yeah. So we wanted to give, clean, high quality water to a community that didn't have it. So we've been doing some stuff like that, which is really exciting. Makes us feel good about what we're doing.
Sure.
We're trying to get these brands out in the market to everybody.
Absolutely. So the last thing that I want to touch on this highest rye is, this is the first one that you've introduced malted rye, at least for this conversation. What is it like making whiskey with malted rye instead of malted barley? Because that whole enzyme process with the B amylase, is that what it is? That is in the malted barley is less than, or is more than in the malted rye, right? So that you have a different chemical compound of the malted rye. So can you talk to us a little bit about the difference between the two?
Yeah, so the enzymatic activity in malted rye is going to be less than malted barley. So we call it the diastatic power. Basically, that's just a fancy word for the ability of that enzymes in that malted grain to reduce starches to fermentable sugars. And so you're going to need a little bit more of that malted rye. But really, with the malted grains, you're also introducing different flavors, and the cocktail of enzymes, the whole, there's a wide array of enzymes in malted grains, and that's going to be slightly different in the malted rye than the malted barley. So you're going to break down different parts of the grain that maybe you're not breaking down with malted barley. Sure. Or with malted rye, vice versa. So it's a different experience. It's just a different flavor profile with the malted rye. But you typically are going to need more of it for conversion.
Does it translate like 10 malted rye is the same as 5 malted barley, or is it not that simple?
It's not quite that simple, just because, we get that diastatic power when we bring in the malted grain. That's part of the certificate of analysis. Mm-hmm. But that's not real constant. Like, it changes from batch to batch, so it's not like malted rye is always this. Sure. Or malted barley is always this. So it changes, but it's significantly mm-hmm. more higher diastatic power with malted barley, especially the malted barley we're bringing in, the sure. distiller's malt, which is a blend of 2-row and 6-row, but it's a very high diastatic power.
Are you permitted to add like additional enzyme outside of the malted grains?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I would say most distilleries do. And we're included in that. It allows us to control the process much better.
Sure.
So really, I think at this point, most distilleries are using those malted grains for flavor development.
Oh, okay.
For conversion, we're using, bacterial enzymes. So you really, with malted grains, you can't control the degree of polymerization of those starches like you might want to during the cooking process.
Sure.
So, you often, especially with heavy rye mash bills, you're going to need to break that viscosity early on in the cooking process. So you're going to need to add, some rheology modifying enzymes or some alpha amylase, something to break that viscosity early in the process. But then when you expose it to higher temperatures, gelatinization temperatures of the starches in corn, especially, if you've created sugars at that part of the process, you're going to degrade those sugars. You're going to get some kind of burnt off flavors from that. So you don't really want to add malt early in the process, but you need to break that viscosity somehow, sure. right? And then, during fermentation, if you're using some kind of glucoamylase, you can really control the amount of sugar available to your yeast all throughout fermentation, because you don't want too much sugar in the beginning.
Right.
You don't want to osmotically stress the yeast, and you want, we call it SSF, simultaneous saccharification and fermentation, you're going to get a lot higher level of consistency using those bacterial enzymes.
Sure.
Or commercial enzymes.
So I'm in love with the nerdy stuff. Like, this is what gets me going, is this conversation right now with the whole chemical compounds and everything. I'm not traditionally educated in like chemical engineering like you are, but what is the benefit of doing study like that coming into the distillery industry, having that chemical engineering, right? You said,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. What is the benefit of going, if there is any, having that background coming into the distillery industry, or just learning basically on the job?
So I think the education helps you understand what's going on in the distillery at a little deeper level.
Okay.
With all the heat transfer that's going on, the biological and chemical reactions that are going on, having that education helps you understand that at a little deeper level instead of just at like a experiential level, I
sure.
guess. Like, we experience things and we take observations, but you really need that science behind it to really understand why.
Sure.
But also, I think the biggest thing is just, you know, I think the engineering and the science background helps because you have to be very scientific, very thorough in everything you do with distilling because you don't understand fully the result of a change you make for years down the road, right? We have our standards of what we want our whiskeys to taste like when they go into the barrel, but we don't fully understand a change until that whiskey comes out of the barrel, right? So any kind of change you make, you want to make small changes, you want to collect a lot of data, you want to be very scientific in any kind of change you're making. And I think that education kind of helps build that mindset before you get into it.
Sure. All right, can we try this last one? And then I want to ask you a couple more questions around the barrel size and everything like that. Because the other thing that we haven't really talked about is the barrels. I mean, we talked about the charring on the barrels, but do you do any experimental distilling or aging with different sizes and not getting into the 52, but getting into lower capacity barrels at all?
So we do not. Okay. At our volumes, it wouldn't make much sense for us to be doing anything in smaller barrels. And in my experience, this is being anecdotal, like I told you we shouldn't be. In my experience, anecdotally, most of the whiskeys I've tried in smaller barrels have not been well balanced to me. And maybe that's just because we're conditioned to think of that balance as a 53-gallon barrel. But, you know, there's a lot we don't know about what happens in the barrel. But, you know, we do know there's basically, you know, three different things going on. You have your oxidation reactions, your organic acids turning into esters, giving you those fruity notes. Basically, you know, when it gets cold, that liquid will absorb more oxygen. Then when it heats back up, those oxidative reactions will occur. And you have your extraction. So you're extracting solubles out of the barrel. And then you have kind of your filtration, you know. The charcoal is going to filter out some off flavors and things. And in a smaller barrel, you're going to have a different volume to surface area ratio. You're going to have, you know, potentially more extraction of those soluble compounds out of the wood faster. But you're not going to speed up those oxidation reactions. And to me, in my experience, that tends to lend itself towards a balance that I don't personally like.
Okay.
So I don't have really any interest in experimenting with the smaller barrels. So it's not something we've done.
Sure.
And maybe we're just snobs and traditionalists, but that's how I feel right now. So.
Well, I mean, kind of to that point, around experimenting with that, do you guys even have time to make experimental distillate at all, or is it kind of trying to stick with what's been working? Like, how much time do you actually have to experiment?
Yeah, so we do experiment, and like I said, we have to be really careful with our experimentation, really scientific about it. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the smaller distilleries can maybe try some like crazier things, right? But, you know, a small run for us is maybe what a craft distillery makes in a year. So so it's hard for us to take big risks, right? Like we do a lot of experimentation, but it better be good or somebody else might be talking to you next year.
Sure. Yeah, right. That's awesome. So we just poured this last one, the Remus Repeal Reserve. Can you talk a little bit about that one?
Yeah, so the Remus Repeal Reserve is probably my favorite part about my job because it's our kind of one time a year where I get to get together with our master blender and we get to pick out, you know, really whatever we want out of the rickhouses. So, you know, it's going to be unique every year. We're not trying to hit a flavor profile every time like we are with the 94 proof. We want it to be different every year. We want it to be unique every year. And we really just kind of get free reign of the rickhouses. This year we did 9, 10, and 16-year-old bourbons for it. You can kind of read those percentages and mash bills. They're very small at the bottom of the barrel or bottle. But it's, you know, it's unique every year, and it's a lot of fun. So we, you know, it kind of blew up with Series 5 in 2021. Guys like Fred Minnick had it in their top five bourbons of 2021. We won a lot of awards. And for Series 6, we kind of continued that momentum. We got second in the Ascot Awards. That was a big deal for us. And then Series 7 we just released, but we're really excited about it, really proud of how this turned out. I've done a lot of blind tastings with people with 7 and some of the previous releases, and it's performed very favorably in the blind tastings. You know, I blind them myself a lot, the whole vertical, and I don't pick the same one every time. You know, a lot of the whiskey YouTubers and influencers, it's fun when they do the blinds and pick them out because they're a lot of times they're not like what they think, right? Sure. Like they'll give one a really good review and one like an okay review, and then they'll blind them and they'll pick the one that they gave the okay review, their favorite. It's kind of funny to watch, but
this is really cool. So it's 100 proof, 50%. There's basically five of them that you're bringing into this bottle.
Yeah, it was five different years in mash bills, sure. Combinations.
Mm-hmm. Three of the 21 rye and two of the 36.
Yep.
So does that stay constant or that's even changing?
No, we've had years where we only pick two different years in mash bills. The last couple years, it has been five. But that's just kind of the way it turned out. It wasn't really intentional at all.
Sure. So this particular, when you're bottling this, is this a distinct thing that you're doing? Because like with the other blends that you have, this type of blend could be in a different bottle, right? Like, but this is just the one that you're kind of pulling out to saying this, we want to separate from the other line.
Yeah. And this, you know, this is going to be some of our older mm-hmm. bourbons typically.
Okay.
So
right. The 16 year. Yeah. You said. Okay.
But yes, those mash bills could be in other things as well.
This is really good. You can taste a lot of that 16, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. kind of funny. Some of like the influencers and reviewers, they're like 6% 2007. What is that, like three drops? And they don't understand that 6% 2007 makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And really, the barrels of that 2007 are going to be like really heavily tannic because, a lot of them are ones that we wouldn't necessarily put into this because they wouldn't perform well on their own, sure. But they make an incredible blending stock. A lot of people don't understand, like they see that and they're like, they're trying to trick us. It's like, no, that's just, that's where we wanted the blend to be, that 6% makes a big difference. Like,
and like kind of going back to our other point, why would you waste a 16-year-old product by trying to trick somebody? Like that doesn't make financial or business sense.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but you can taste a lot of that, like that deepness, because with older products, you kind of get or at least in my opinion, you get more of the lasting effect where it just kind of, the flavors stay, or at least the oak and the more traditional older notes stay in your taste for quite a bit longer. And with that, I attribute that, and I could be wrong based off of what you've done your research on this, but like that 6%, I'm attributing it to that lasting note that has been very prevalent ever since I took that first sip. Like it's just staying there. And I attribute that to a little bit older of a product.
Yeah, I think that that may be accurate. I think that older products tend to be a little more complex as a generalization. Mm-hmm. But but like I said, every barrel is different. Some barrels are really honestly going to be best at like 4 years old. Like sure. That barrel reached its peak at 4 years old. We in our single barrel program this year, the LESV, the 21% rye. The youngest batch in there was like the standout. Like it was, 4.5 year old, 21% rye, and it was just incredible. Mm-hmm. And like I don't want that whiskey to age much longer, right? Because it's so good right now. Typically, the older bourbons are going to add some complexity. Some of those lingering notes. I think mm-hmm. I agree with that. Yeah.
So to kind of round out the conversation, I know that we talked a little bit about the smaller barrels, you not necessarily finding a lot of value in doing that. Are there any other bourbon or whiskey trends that you feel aren't valuable or don't provide, from your perspective, the return on the investment, I guess, to say? Kind of putting you on the spot there. You don't necessarily have to call out something.
I don't know that I see... I definitely see some that aren't valuable, but I think some of the ones that I do think are valuable are, I think that right now there's a really good trend going in the industry where distillers are getting more involved in the agriculture side of it.
Sure.
So like the winemakers are so far ahead of what we've been doing as distillers in terms of, you know, understanding the different varietals of the grapes, the different growing conditions, the regions.
Terroir.
Than distillers. And I think it's exciting to see the distilling world start to get into that. I think that's one of the things that really excites me in my job right now. Really understanding more of that agricultural connection, you know, how, you know, frost seeding crops affects the flavor profile.
Sure.
How different regions and different rye varieties affect the flavor profile. I think that's one of the exciting trends in bourbon. I won't comment on the ones I don't think are worth it.
So that's an interesting topic, because I think you're starting to see that now with the regionalization of whiskey, like New York having their own category now, the Empire Rye. From somebody that is MGP, do you see the regionalization of different whiskey products beneficial to the whiskey industry, or do you feel like it's taking too much away? I mean, I guess you kind of answered that question, but like, what are your thoughts on like Texas potentially being the next state that has their own like Texas whiskey, or Alabama or Washington, like that type of conversation?
No, I think all of that is great. I'd much rather see that. I like it when other distilleries and newer distilleries really like, you know, make their distillery their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've seen distilleries like copy other distilleries' mash bills and stuff, specifically our mash bills a lot. And I'm like, you could make any mash bill you wanted.
Right.
Why would you want to do something that's already been done? So I think, no, it's great when... you know, they're making it regional, because every distillery is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're never going to be able to create the whiskey we make. We're never going to be able to recreate the whiskey another distillery makes. You know, Seagram's did a lot of research back on in the day on that. They had a whole team of PhDs working at our distillery back in the day, and they were trying to recreate the rye whiskey that we make at one of their other facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And they went as far as trucking in the water and the grain, and there was... being distilled on basically the same equipment, because it was all designed by Seagram Central Engineering. And what they kind of came to the conclusion of is that, you know, every little, you know, place of a distillery is going to have a slightly different, you know, we have slightly different bacteria in the air, slightly different wild yeast,
mm-hmm.
and all of that is going to create a unique profile that you just, each distillery is different. You can't recreate something else somewhere
sure.
else, right?
Every
the location is truly important. It is that terroir, you know, and it's great when other distilleries embrace that, embrace their regionality. You know, I think it's great when they're, you know, sourcing grains for locally. You know, for us, we do it a little more scientifically, and we're looking for a specific flavor profile. But we do some stuff with small farmers too. You know, some experimental things.
Sure. This is awesome. I mean, we could probably talk for quite a bit longer, but I want to be respectful for your time. And I want to I just want to have people understand Remus as a whole. So we talked a little bit about the potential single malt discussion coming on in some foreseeable future. Is there anything else that people can be looking forward to from the Remus or the Rossville brand that you want to point out? Or if you don't want to point it out right now, where can people be in tune for these announcements if they do happen?
On our social media, on Facebook, follow Remus Bourbon, Rossville Union, Rossville Squibb, join the King Circle. We don't have anything specifically we want to talk about at this
sure.
moment, but we do have some really cool innovation coming for the following years, and we've put down some whiskey, you know, that's really cool that we don't even know what that innovation is going to look like in the future. We just have some cool whiskey to lay down, and, you know, maybe we'll turn it into some of our own brands in the future.
Yeah. Love that. So everybody, go give them a follow on their social media. If you see the Remus brand in store, go pick it up, because that's what MGP wants MGP to taste like. Go check it out. All these products that we had today were absolutely fantastic. Is there a like quantity of all the different products that you offer? Like, we have five in front of us. What are we talking total for Remus in Rossville?
So this is the whole Remus portfolio as it stands today. The Rossville portfolio, it has our Rossville Bottled and Bond, which is a 7-year, and that's my personal favorite of the whole lineup. Rossville Barrel Proof, and that's 7-year, and that's my personal favorite. And then we also have our Rossville 94 proof as well.
Okay.
So, but that's the whole lineup right now. And then we also, you know, as a whole company, you know, we have a lot more with our friends from Luxco and our Kentucky distilleries. But
love that. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Go check them out. Ian, this has been a pleasure. I really appreciate it. This has been awesome. All these products are fantastic. They all have a different experience to it. But I think I'm going Gatsby.
Thank you. the Gatsby's incredible. It's one of my favorite as well. And it's always fun when people come over. They're like, you know, they know it's special when you break out that bottle.
Sure. Awesome. Well, thank you, everybody. Cheers. Thank you.
Yeah, cheers. Thank you.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.